This morning, we welcome Reverend Denise Gouch as our speaker. She came to Unitarian Universalism by way of a Roman Catholic youth in a military family and a young adulthood spent at Vanderbilt University, where she almost completed a doctorate in historical theology. But she had a bit more fun managing the Divinity School bookstore. She has been a member of the First UU Church in Nashville since 2001. She joined the church staff there in 2005 as membership coordinator. Denise earned the Master of Divinity degree from Vanderbilt University in 2011, and she was ordained to the UU ministry jointly by First UU Nashville and the UU Church of Huntsville, Alabama in 2015. She enjoys sharing life in and out of church with partner David Lewis and their two children. Her primary passion these days is looking for ways to support the growth of Unitarian Universalism in Middle Tennessee and the Southern region. Reverend Gouch will speak on the topic, Even to Question Truly is an Answer. Let's welcome Reverend Gouch.
Thank you. It is so good, as always, to be with you all this morning. I will apologize in advance because I'm going to cough. I just know it. Morning's where things are. Over the years, I have heard lots and lots of Unitarian Universalists tell their stories of how they came to be Unitarian Universalists, as I'm sure many of you have. Despite the varieties of stories we hear, it seems to me not at all uncommon for our UU siblings, in reflecting on their individual spiritual or religious paths, to describe themselves as having been children who asked lots of questions. Often, they or we report that we made the adults in our lives, whether parents, teachers, religious educators, or other authority figures, uncomfortable. It is not uncommon to hear that children have been asked or told to stop asking, to be quiet, to do as they were told, to go away. Sometimes we didn't receive such blunt responses to our questions, but we still remember feeling out of place, receiving puzzled looks or teasing comments in response to our questions about the world and our places in it. It occurs to me reading this paragraph, I'm not sure that experience, those experiences are confined to childhood. Some of us as adults still feel that way sometimes. I consider myself fairly fortunate in this respect. It wasn't until a college stint in ROTC that I recall someone insisting that I do as I was told and ask questions later. That particular exchange didn't really feel like an invitation to future dialogue, and it might have been when I started to realize that I wasn't sure I would enjoy life as an adult in the military, even if it had been a good place to grow up. As a child, I lived in a fairly authoritarian household, but authority in our world was mostly benign, assumed to be thoughtfully exercised, reasonable in the imposition of rules, and ultimately responsible to higher authorities. My parents modeled authority that was loving and attentive to the needs of me and my siblings. Furthermore, they both, in different ways, took advantage of our military and Roman Catholic lives to explore diversity and to push boundaries. My mother has always considered herself a truth seeker before all else. And I remember my father as a voracious and wide-ranging reader who sought out interesting conversation and friendships in circles of folks whom he never would have met if not for his military career. We were an observant Roman Catholic family, and my folks were proud to be able to send us to Catholic schools. Now, I have heard and read many, many stories of folks for whom a Catholic education was less than ideal. And my own had its rough spots, but on the whole, I was taught by a very interesting bunch of dedicated teachers, many of whom shared our UU propensity toward asking interesting questions and exploring new perspectives. They also shared what I think is, if you notice in their seven principles, the center one, the fourth, is a search for truth and justice, a free and responsible search. And I learned that really from the Roman Catholic tradition as it was being taught at the moment I was growing up in it. Some of this openness and the positivity of my Catholic upbringing, I think, might be due, at least in part, to the timing of my intersection with Catholic education, because it was in the decade after the Second Vatican Council, which had brought broad cultural and intellectual change. And that moment in American Roman Catholic history in particular was marked by a sweeping openness. Whatever the reason for my own experience, I was never made to feel growing up that asking questions in and of itself was problematic. I didn't think too much about questions, as a matter of fact, until I was in high school, where an extraordinary teacher who undertook an experiment, really, of teaching freshmen and sophomores an interdisciplinary course where we read Norse mythology and C.S. Lewis and studied history and theology and art and music and had lots and lots of choice about what we could research and talk about in small groups and wrote interesting papers. But this teacher, at one point, told me that I was good at questions. I was going, We were discussing, and actually this may have been he and I, or in a very small group, I can't remember. We were discussing church history, specifically the final split between the Roman Catholic and Eastern Orthodox patriarchs, which hinges on the very un-Unitarian question of how the Trinity relates to itself, how the persons in the Trinity relate to each other. And specifically, it focuses on one small suffix. In Latin, it's Q-U-E, which simply means and. So if you are less than fluent in traditional Trinitarian theology, allow me to share that Trinitarian Christians conceive of God as being composed of three persons, Father, Son, Holy Spirit. We Unitarians have long felt that it might be simpler to bypass all the problems that come with trying to explain how a single God can be three persons. In fact, those problems took ancient Christians centuries to reach an orthodox solution, and most theologians today still agree that these ideas need to be repeatedly reworked or reinterpreted in new historical and cultural situations. What seemed to me to be a squabble going on in the early 13th century between the Pope in Rome and the Patriarch in Constantinople was about whether the official statement of faith in Christianity should describe the Holy Spirit as proceeding from the Father through the Son, or from the Father and the Son. There's the qua. It was the Father, the Son, and. That little suffix. So sometimes you hear people call it the filioque. And filio is son. Filioque is and the son. So one side says, does the Holy Spirit come through the Son or from the Father and the Son? And this is the official story by some lights of how Eastern Orthodoxy and Roman Catholicism got separated. Okay. Yeah. There was a little more to the story. But at the time, it seemed amazing to me that such a huge historical event could be blamed on three letters added to the end of the word son. And it seemed a pretty shaky base on which to build the edifice of distinctively Western Christian thought and practice within which I was currently standing. I was, by this time, aware that other important moments in Christian theological history hinged on similarly small details that came to carry huge weight for the parties on opposite sides of various debates. And so I asked, how do we know that we are right? My teacher did have a theologically based answer to that question, designed, I think, to encourage my teenaged faith. But what I remember most about the ensuing exchange was not the answer to my question, but the attitude with which it was received. He said nothing to suggest that I should not have asked it. What he said was, that's a really good question. Although he suggested an answer to my question, his answer was offered as a possible way to think about the historical problem at hand and referred to an authority both within and outside the human sphere. For him, it was the Holy Spirit he talked about. And he did so in a way that left me with the impression that the question, and not the theologically based answer, was the important part of our conversation that day. He modeled a positive appreciation of questions and a trust that they can function to open up conversation instead of threatening truth. When he told me that I am good at questions, he gifted me with a lifelong identity as someone who loves questions and recognizes them as valuable tools. So, I've decided that right now what the world needs is good questions. I could be wrong about that. That's an open question. But this has been, for me, an interesting summer. Perhaps every summer is interesting. I know similar things happened last summer, and the summer before, and during the summers of the last decade, and the summers of every decade before that. But this summer, and maybe this is just me, I have been noticing more of the troublesome, and the tragic, and the wrong, and the sad things that are going on. And because I am now a minister who frequently gets up on Sunday mornings to address gathered congregations, I think that I should have something significant to say, something wise or helpful or reassuring or useful in helping us all to come to terms with the realities and frailties of human life. I should be able, I think, to suggest appropriate values-driven responses to the crises and upheavals of our world, or to offer words of comfort, or to issue much-needed challenges, or maybe to suggest plans for effective action. But our world these days is a very, very wordy one. Whatever words I can offer have quite likely already been posted on somebody's Facebook page and applauded by so many people that it seems unlikely my own voice is needed. Or maybe my tentative ideas have already been picked apart from so many different critical perspectives that to risk putting my thoughts out there seems a waste of time and energy. Besides, with a few searches, I, or anyone else, can find and read on websites, various social media platforms, any thoughts that I might have, sometimes with more depth and polish than I can offer in any sermon. It's easier and safer to just be a spectator, especially when I feel, quite frequently, inadequate to the task of careful wording. So some days I just wade through thousands and thousands of words, ranging from those probably not really worth reading, to the truly inspiring, with a whole lot of time spent on words somewhere in between. On some of my less productive days, I may even descend into the comment section below a provocative piece, which is rarely edifying. What I do find edifying, and far too rare, is a writer or a commentator or speaker in the public sphere who poses thoughtful, useful, weighty questions. Questions that might actually take us into new perspectives and better understanding of the problems, which, let's face it, most of us would really like to solve. Even rarer is conversation that resists the impulse to skip directly to propose solutions before trying to appreciate the problem. I'm not talking about fully understanding everything about a problem before trying to address it, but about the fallacy of thinking a good and lasting solution can come from a superficial understanding of problems that may have been years, decades, or centuries in the making. These are times, I think, that call us to resist the impulse to formulate answers, to pause in the rush to declare what we know or to set aside our own pet solutions to difficult problems. At these times, perhaps, the world might be better served if we leaned toward what the poet Rilke described as living the questions. You may know the famous and oft-quoted passage about questions, which Rilke wrote to a younger poet in the very early 20th century. It seems that many folks are finding them as fresh as ever these days. I'm going to skip around a little bit and add a few words at the beginning that you may not have heard because they're not quoted as often. But he writes to his young friend. And you know what? Rilke was very young when he wrote these letters too. He was 27 or 28. I am touched by your beautiful anxiety about life. There is no one anywhere who can answer for you those questions and feelings which in their depths have a life of their own. For even the most articulate people are unable to help, since what words point to is so very delicate, is almost unsayable. I would like to beg you, dear sir, as well as I can, to have patience with everything unresolved in your heart, and to try to love the questions themselves as if they were locked rooms or books written in a very foreign language. Don't search for the answers, which could not be given to you now, because you would not be able to live them. And the point is to live everything. Live the questions now. Perhaps then, someday far in the future, You will gradually, without even noticing it, live your way into the answer. What I'd like to do this morning is to suggest that we cultivate a habit of paying more attention to questions, and maybe sometimes pay more attention to the questions than we pay to their answers. So I have two things I want to do. One is to talk about what I think a good question is, and the other is then to talk a little bit about how do we live the questions. And this is all kind of hard to put a finger on, but I've been looking, since I've been thinking about this sermon over the last several years, to start paying attention to where I see good questions. So a lot of this is going to be a little bit impressionistic, and I hope you'll come later and share with me some of what you think about questions and where you find good questions. One of the things I realized is poets are very, very good at questions. And I know most of you have heard Mary Oliver, and you probably know this poem, but it's chock full of good ones, so I'm going to read it again. It's also seasonally appropriate. It's entitled The Summer Day. Who made the world? Who made the swan and the black bear? Who made the grasshopper? This grasshopper, I mean, the one who has flung herself out of the grass, the one who is eating sugar out of my hand, who is moving her jaws back and forth instead of up and down, who is gazing around with her enormous and complicated eyes. Now she lifts her pale forearms and thoroughly washes her face. Now she snaps her wings open and floats away. I don't know exactly what a prayer is. I do know how to pay attention, how to fall down into the grass, how to kneel down in the grass, how to be idle and blessed, how to stroll through the fields, which is what I have been doing all day. Tell me, what else should I have done? Doesn't everything die at last and too soon? Tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life? So there's good question number one. What is it you plan to do with your wild and precious life, your one wild and precious life? You've heard that probably before. You'll hear it again. It's a good question to sit with. Sometimes I think good questions don't really look like questions. They're not phrased as questions. I found this one, actually just this morning, I stuck it in here, because I opened up my computer to print this out, and there was on a sticky note on my desktop, Mr. Rogers. I don't even remember where I read this, his interview with somebody, but he says, what matters isn't how a person's inner life finally puts together the alphabet and numbers of his outer life. What really matters is whether he uses the alphabet for the declaration of a war or the description of a sunrise, his numbers for the final count at Buchenwald or the specifics of a brand new bridge. It's been lots of questions off of that. It's kind of the same question as Mary Oliver's, but it's different. There are questions that could be good questions, but often are not. How are you? How can I help? What do you want? Sometimes we really want answers. Sometimes we don't. Sometimes we just toss them out there. Where does it hurt? Here's one I've been focused on lately. How could they do that? We keep getting, this has been my experience of this summer, has been that week after week or day after day sometimes we're getting, there's new stories, new terrible things people have done. Sometimes they're kind of trivial or by comparison trivial things people have done that are bad. And it's like, how could you do that? Sometimes they're really big, bad. But we say, how could they do that? And we say that because we're judging. That is unthinkable. How could a human being do that? And we don't really mean, I want to know how someone could get to the point of doing that. But that could be a good question. It could be, really, how could someone do that? And that could be very scary. I don't really know that I want to live every day fully in the knowledge of how somebody gets to the point of being a suicide bomber. Or lots of other things. But if I want to make the world a safer place for everyone, if I want to increase the amount of love in the world as opposed to the amount of fear, I might need to go with that. What do I need to understand to be able to shift things in the world? How could they do that? I found last winter, in the wake of the bombings in Paris, there was a poem. I think it went viral. I got it eventually. But it was written by a poet in Great Britain who was a Somali family. She was born in Kenya, though. They were refugees, and they moved to Great Britain when she was a toddler. But she wrote a poem called What They Did Yesterday Afternoon that I'd like to share with you, because she has another good question in there. They set my aunt's house on fire. I cried the way women on TV do, folding at the middle like a 5-pound note. I called the boy who used to love me, tried to okay my voice. I said, hello. He said, Warson, what's wrong? What's happened? I've been praying, and these are what my prayers look like. Dear God, I come from two countries. One is thirsty, the other is on fire. Both need water. Later that night, I held an atlas in my lap, ran my fingers across the whole world, and whispered, where does it hurt? It answered, everywhere, everywhere, everywhere. And as you might imagine, that poem, and I should have said the poet's name is Warsan Shire. Her name is in the poem. That poem got picked up, and lots of bloggers and ministers wrote prayers around that poem. Where does it hurt? And this image of sitting, actually, I imagined her sitting with an atlas in her lap, like a mother holds a child, or a father, a parent, a caregiver, somebody who loves somebody, folding somebody's heart. Where does it hurt? How can we pay attention? The world, where does it hurt? It hurts everywhere. It hurts. So our attention is called for everywhere, which can feel overwhelming when we move into the wanting to find answers, especially because we can't be everywhere answering every need. So I've been compiling a short list of questions I think are good questions. One of the ones I have loved for years, I had a teacher back in my graduate school days, who's a history teacher, but he said our papers, our work should always keep in the back of our minds the so what question. So you can ask really great or very academic sounding, impressive academic questions, and follow all your data and build your arguments and do something really impressive. But if you don't let your audience know why they should care about that, or even if you don't know yourself, and I think a lot of us academic types will tend to just, it's just fun to like solve a puzzle. He said, so what? So what? Why do we care about this piece of history or that piece of data or set of data? So what? So what's a good question? Here's some others I've picked up just from the air around me. What does it mean to say that a life matters? What response is called for here from me or from us? What would a culture of gratitude look like? This one came from an argument in an article that I read, I think in the New York Times, I don't remember. Does our love of melodrama, especially as presented by the media, get in the way of addressing disaster proactively? How do we know we are right? How could they do that? Is this, whatever this is this coming from love or fear? How could we respond out of love instead of fear? Right now I'm reading a book, and I wrote down the title. Yes. It's called Braiding Sweetgrass, Indigenous Wisdom, Scientific Knowledge, and the Teachings of Plants. Somebody asked me the other day, somebody sitting next to me on a plane, what I was reading. And I said, oh, it's this book. It's by a botanist, and she's also a Native American, and she's an academic, so she travels a lot and has taught in lots of different places. And she just asks really good questions. And some of the questions she has, what is an education for? What would it mean to be citizens of Maple Nation? I love this. She saw somewhere somebody coming out of a native, you know, or indigenous culture had drawn a map of North America and done the geographical regions by the dominant plant. And so she was, at the time she encountered this, she was living in upstate New York. And so she was in Maple Nation. So what would it mean to be a good citizen of Maple Nation? And what do we learn from the maple trees? And what do the maple trees require from us to thrive? And how does that support the thriving of human communities? It's just a really rich question. She has this question, so what's the difference between the scientific worldview and the practice of science on the ground? How are they different? So what I find that all of these questions have in common is that the ones that I think are good questions, they open up new possibilities. They nurture connections and reciprocity. I think that's really why I liked Braiding Sweetgrass so much, because she's all about connection, big, very seventh principle-ish kind of connections, you know, translated into my own language, because it's connections to the plants and the animals and humans among each other and different human communities with each other. So connections, for me, that's me. Connections and reciprocity are always part of good questions. Good questions enable new conversations, or perhaps they extend or reframe old conversations. Good questions require patience. They're not usually things that we can just answer really quickly. Really great questions simply don't have easy answers. And they're invitations to change or transformation, maybe invitations to openness, to new perspectives, invitations to pay attention. And so we come to the question of what to do with a good question. How do we live the questions, in the words of the poet Rilke? Here's my list. You might have other ideas. I think the first thing often is to avoid the lure of urgency. Our culture, things have a really short life now. Have you noticed? I mean, when your inbox gets really full, there's no space for a thoughtful email anymore because it's going to get buried under the avalanche of stuff. We've kind of picked up the pace of everything. If there's a great Facebook post, it doesn't matter how provocative it is, it's stale in 2 days. And if I post on it 2 months later, everybody thinks, oh my goodness, wasn't she following her Facebook 2 months ago? No, I wasn't. But I think to sit with a good question, to live a question, requires us somehow to find space not to answer quickly, not to try to think it through, to be able to hold it, to hold it open, to maybe say, that might be an answer. What else? And what else? And what else? To mull it over, turn it over, or turn it around in your mind. See what happens. Do new things come up? Does something old come up when you sit with a question? Maybe something old comes up in a new way, or with new emphasis, or new energy. What does the question feel like? And that's going to be different for different people, because we all have different places we feel things. Some of us are in our head. So what does it feel like in your thought? What does it do to your thoughts? How does that change as you hold it open? Or maybe some of us feel things in our bodies. So where does that question sit in your body? And what does that mean? Does that suggest where an answer might lie in a new direction? And how do those feelings, those perceptions of the way the question feels in our life, does that change over time, over a week or a month or a year? You can also park a question on the back burner and just wait. A lot of times then you'll dream something. I don't tend to have answers in dreams, but some people tell me they do, and they're really amazing. So if you just put it on the back burner, sometimes things start simmering and new stuff gets added to the pot, and someday you end up, oh, you've lived into the question and its answer without knowing. And then my favorite always is talk it over with people, with friends, with strangers, with acquaintances. That's part of the reason we all come here on Sunday morning. So thank you to listening to my musings about questions, I have decided to try this summer. Really, this is intense, some of what's going on in our world. I think it's always been intense, and there's another question to think about. But I've decided for now what I need to do is learn to live with questions and find better questions, because these are not old, these are not new problems, a lot of them. So I invite you to sit with questions, to be with your questions, and to consider that sometimes to question truly is an answer. Thank you.